It is time now to begin our reading of today's Boston Herald for this Tuesday, the 7th of April, 2026. And with the Boston Herald, we say hello to Mary Ellen.
Welcome, everyone. This is Mary Ellen. I'm going to start off with a column by Colleen Cronin, a feel-good column under the subsection Chestnut Hill, entitled Cop and Ex-Commish Team Up to Save a Man. When a patron started choking at Capitol Grill, an unlikely team stepped into action. When a man started choking during dinner at the Capitol Grill in Chestnut Hill the night before Easter, an unlikely team stepped in to rescue him. The managing partner of the restaurant, an off-duty Boston police officer, and former Boston Police Commissioner William Gross. By the time Gross arrived at the table, the man, who he said was in his 80s, had already collapsed. He was gray from lack of oxygen, and the man's kids and grandkids had started shouting in the busy restaurant during the holiday weekend, asking for help, quote, doing all the right things, end quote, Gross said. Gross told the Herald in a phone interview, quote, then out of nowhere I see one of my officers, end quote. It was Patrolman Stephen Bourne, B-O-R-N-E, a community service officer working out of Brighton, who was there that night for a dinner with his wife and kids off duty. Together, they got the gentleman into the recovery position, striking him in the back to try to dislodge the obstruction in his throat. Chris Lynch, the restaurant's managing partner, also stepped in. Gross said, recalling asking Lynch to sweep for the blockage, which he was able to successfully remove, then telling Bourne to check the man's vitals, Gross said, quote, we were sounding like a TV show, end quote. Bourne said, quote, you just revert to your training, end quote. Even though the airways were clear, he didn't have a pulse. Bourne started chest compression. Gross administered breaths. George Regan, head of Regan Communications Group and a friend of the former commissioner who was dining with him that night, said that at one point Gross had to tell the packed place to, quote, shut up, end quote, just so he could hear if the man was breathing. Gross said, quote, I was a little rude, end quote. Regan laughed, recalling the moment, and said his friend was a hero. Although Gross and Bourne said they lost his pulse twice, by the time Newton Fire and EMS arrived, the man had been resuscitated and even tried to stand up himself to get into an ambulance. Bourne said he was thankful to be able to put his skills to good use. All officers are trained at the Boston Police Academy and by the Red Cross. Saturday night ended in, quote, the best case scenario, end quote, said Bourne. Gross said, quote, it was teamwork. We were just happy they had a good Easter, end quote. When talking to the Herald on the phone, Gross said he was about to call Capitol Grill's corporate office to commend them for Lynch's role in the rescue. Talking about Bourne, Gross said, quote, I still love my troops, end quote. When the on-duty first responders arrived and the man was taken to the hospital in stable condition, Regan said the restaurant gave them a standing ovation and the management sent over a full dessert cart. Thinking about the coincidence of all being there that night to help at the right moment, Gross said he thanked God, adding, quote, who puts that together, end quote. And that was Colleen Cronin writing. Next is Joe Battenfeld with his commentary today, entitled Boo Birds Revealing for Healy and Wu. The politicians got an earful at Fenway Park, and it wasn't good. How dare the lowly rabble at Fenway Park treat our esteemed mayor and governor with such disrespect? They must have been tipsy from those $12 beers as 37,000 strong unleashed a torrent of booze when the Duncan Queen and the, quote, "this is our city," end quote, mayor of the people were introduced. It couldn't possibly have anything to do with bankrupting the state, with illegal migrant coddling, massive SNAP fraud, taxing and spending and busting the budget, or forcing a soccer stadium down the throats of local residents. What we have here is a failure to communicate and audit. Don't these boo-birds deplorables know the Red Sox are owned by the husband of the Globe CEO, where Michelle Wu and Mara Healy have a permanent hall pass? Booing John Henry is one thing, especially with the way the season has started, but our star politicians? Where's the fans' team spirit? How are they treating Wu and Healy so shabbily? It must be all Trump's fault, and they took it so well. Healy wearing her crisp white Red Sox uniform, and Wu dressed in resplendent red with her Red Sox hat, looked somewhat stunned at the reaction, but did not flee. Healy brought her partner, Joanna Lydgate, to the game. Wu brought her baby to the game to meet Wally, but did not have the baby to protect her when the booing commenced. And while the crowd was clearly heard, were Healy and Wu listening? The booing went national on social media, leading some to defend the pair or dismiss the booing as just a nothing burger. But it's worth exploring. Why is it that the booing was so loud? Was it just a spontaneous action? Or have people had enough with their style of governing? It's not like Fenway Park is a beacon for the MAGA crowd. They weren't speaking at CPAC or Turning Point USA. Wasn't Wu just overwhelmingly re-elected by Boston voters? Is it just too expensive for the average voter to go to a game now? You just know the naysayers at the game were from out of town. They clearly don't know the governor, and Chicago transplant are one of them. Or perhaps all the booing was from those that have wisely fled the state. Maybe Healy and Wu and other extreme left politicians should take heed. You can't just laugh and smile your way through being lustily booed by 37,000 people. Healy can make all the munchkin jokes she wants, but she'll never live down the ribbing she got at Fenway. If liberals want us to listen to the No Kings protesters, shouldn't Wu and Healy have to listen to the No Queens protesters? And even despite the boos, Wu and Healy executed their one rehearsed line so well. Play ball. No thanks. I don't think we will. And that was Joe Battenfeld writing today. In a related article, Gayla Cawley is writing under the subsection City Hall entitled "The Wu Budget Eyes $100 Million Spending Hike." Increase comes amid financial crunch and current year budget gap. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu proposed a $4.9 billion budget for fiscal year 2027, saying that the 2% increase over last year's spending represents the lowest growth in 17 years as the city continues to cut back amid a financial crunch. Still, the budget is increasing by roughly $100 million, a spike that appears to be largely driven by an $88 million spending increase for Boston Public Schools. Wu framed her budget proposal to the City Council Monday as a reflection of her administration's, quote, deliberate and disciplined approach to protecting the services our residents and businesses rely on while investing in the long-term strength and stability of our city, end quote, in a letter to councilors. And Wu wrote in the letter, quote, across the Commonwealth and the country, cities and towns face a challenging fiscal environment marked by rising costs, slowing revenue growth, economic uncertainty, and inflationary pressure. Boston is navigating these conditions within the constraints of the Commonwealth's rigid limitations on municipal revenue generation and diversification, including Prop 2.5. And as she added, this is a difficult moment, but Boston meets it from a position of durability and determination. More than a decade of AAA bond ratings, disciplined financial stewardship, and strong reserves have positioned the city to weather this environment. Because of the work we have done together over the past several years, the city approaches this moment from a place of stability, end quote. Wu said the city is intentionally limiting spending this year, saying that this year's proposed budget increase at 2.1%, quote, is the lowest rate since FY10 and, quote, well below the current rate of inflation, end quote. By comparison, the city's budget grew by 4% this year and 8% the previous year. Wu said, quote, this limited growth has required tough choices, including targeted reductions, end quote. Wu officials said many long-term vacant positions won't be filled, but the city is not anticipating layoffs at this point. The mayor proposed her budget for FY27 a week after her administration shared that it was scrambling to close a $48.4 million budget gap for the current fiscal year, FY26, that ends June 30th, by freezing some spending and delaying hiring. The shortfall, her chief financial officer, Ashley Groffenberger, said last week, was driven by overspending on snow removal due to two major winter storms and public safety overtime. Given the $53 million projected deficit for Boston Public Schools for this fiscal year, the city has a more than $100 million deficit to close FY26 as it pitches an increased spending plan for next year. The mayor's proposed FY27 budget for Boston Public Schools is $1.72 billion, which represents an $88 million or 5.4% increase over last year's spending. And that was Gayla Cawley writing on that issue. Tim Dunn of the Boston Herald staff is writing next under the subsection GOP primary entitled Short Sleeve Collects National Nod. U.S. Senator Tom Cotton calls the candidate a, quote, warrior for conservative values, end quote. U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, has announced his endorsement of Republican Massachusetts gubernatorial candidate Brian Shortsleeve as the 2026 election, as well as the April Massachusetts GOP convention, draw closer. Cotton, a former Army officer, said, quote, Brian and I may have a friendly rivalry between the Army and the Marines, but there's no question about this. Brian Shortsleeve is a warrior for conservative values. He served our country as a Marine officer with honor, and he brought that same discipline and mission focus to building businesses and reforming the state government. Massachusetts needs that kind of leadership in the corner office, end quote. Cotton was first elected in 2013 to the House of Representatives, serving one term before being elected to the Senate in 2015. Currently, Cotton serves as the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, as well as the Senate Republican Conference. He was on the short list of President Trump's potential Supreme Court nominees in 2020, until Trump ultimately went with Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Shortsleeve welcomed Cotton's endorsement, calling it, quote, a tremendous honor, end quote, while also highlighting the lessons in leadership he says the two gained during their service in the military. Shortsleeve said in a statement, quote, it is a tremendous honor to have the support of Senator Tom Cotton, one of America's leading conservative reformers. We both learned in uniform that leadership means putting the mission first and never backing down from a tough fight. I'm proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with Tom in the fight for common sense. As governor, I will bring that same mission mindset to Beacon Hill. We will finally put Massachusetts families first by auditing state government, reining in runaway spending, and restoring affordability by lowering taxes and eliminating costly utility fees, end quote. Cotton says Shortsleeve has a long record as, quote, a principled conservative, end quote, pointing to Shortsleeve's promise to provide, quote, fiscal discipline, end quote, on Beacon Hill if elected. Cotton said, quote, Brian is a consistent, lifelong conservative who knows how to grow an economy and create jobs through fiscal discipline, low taxes, individual freedom, accountability, and the rule of law. I hope Massachusetts Republicans will unite behind Brian Shortsleeve and send a Marine to fix what Beacon Hill politicians have broken, end quote. The endorsement from Cotton adds to quite a busy past few weeks for the Shortsleeve campaign. Less than 2 weeks ago, Shortsleeve announced that he's selected New Bedford City Councilor Sean Oliver as his Lieutenant Governor candidate. Shortsleeve will face off against Republican candidates Mike Keneally and Mike Minogue in the September primary election. And that was Tim Dunn writing on that issue. Grace Zokovich is writing under the subsection Technology. Her article entitled Social Media Ban Teed Up on Beacon Hill. The bill would restrict use for young minors along with bell-to-bell limit in schools. And this is Grace Zokovich. Massachusetts may join a growing list of states attempting to outright ban social media usage for young minors, with the House scheduled to take up legislation addressing the issue this week. House Speaker Ron Mariano and Ways and Means Chair Aaron Mikowicz, in a joint statement, said, quote, the bill prohibits social media use for children under 14 in Massachusetts and requires platforms to obtain parental consent for users ages 14 and 15. This ban would be among the most restrictive in the entire country, helping to protect young people from harmful content and addictive algorithms that have a proven negative impact on their mental health, end quote. From Mariano and Mikovits. The House bill would implement the social media ban as of October 2026, requiring companies to implement age verification systems, as well as enacting a requirement for school districts to prohibit the use of cell phones and other personal electronic devices during the school day. House lawmakers are scheduled to take up and vote on the bill Wednesday. The state Senate previously approved the cell phone in schools policy in July, but have not cleared a social media ban. Massachusetts' potential social media restrictions tracks with a number of similar initiatives in many states, several including Florida, Arkansas, California, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Ohio, Nebraska, and Tennessee have enacted legislation banning use or requiring parental consent for minors up to 17 years old and enforcing fines for companies. Legal challenges across the country have put holds on many of the measures, disputing whether the bans violate First Amendment protections. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed Mississippi's law to remain in effect during ongoing litigation, while an Ohio law was blocked outright by a federal judge last April. Online businesses trade association NetChoice has led several legal challenges and said of the Massachusetts proposal that such bans, quote, block lawful speech and create massive security risks that lead to data breaches, end quote. In December, Australia became the first country to ban use of most major social media sites, including Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, Meta, YouTube, and more, for kids under 16 years old, followed by Indonesia in March. The Australian ban requires companies to use, quote, reasonable steps, end quote, to keep kids off the sites, including government-issued IDs, facial or voice recognition, or, quote, age inference, end quote, technology to estimate age based on behavior. Mikovits said Monday that the Massachusetts proposal is, quote, probably more in line with closer to what Florida has done, end quote. The proposal allows anyone 16 or older to use the platforms freely without parental consent. The bill gives parents of minor users access to data submitted by the users on the platforms and requires the Attorney General to construct regulations to implement the ban by September, a month before it would go into effect. The similar Florida law remains in appeals court 2 years after it was signed by Governor Ron DeSantis. Lawmakers believe the proposal is on, quote, solid ground, end quote, Mikovits said Monday, and hope it would, quote, stand up through any legal challenges, end quote. The social media and cell phone bans have both been supported by Governor Maura Healey. The governor announced the social media restrictions for young teens and kids in her State of the Commonwealth address in January, based on recommendations from the Attorney General. Healey said, quote, these platforms are built with addictive algorithms, and they exploit insecurities, especially in our young people. So I am proposing strict new requirements to protect kids and teens on social media, we will require parental consent and age verification on all of these platforms. We're going to prevent social media companies from targeting kids for profit, end quote. Healy said she would host a press briefing on the measure on Tuesday ahead of the House vote. The cell phone restriction would require DESE to give districts a model, quote, bell-to-bell, end quote, ban to enforce no use of personal electronic devices in school and create a pilot program to with 10 districts using technology to prevent students from using devices. Mikovits and Mariano stated, quote, the simple reality is that Massachusetts must do more to ensure that our laws keep pace with modern challenges, especially when it comes to protecting our children and to setting students up for success in the classroom and beyond. We look forward to productive conversations with the membership in the coming days and to passing this important legislation on Wednesday, end quote. And State House News reporting contributed to this article. And that was Grace Zokovich writing. Rick Sobey is writing next under the subsection Stoughton, his article entitled The Feds Reveal DNA Evidence in the Birchmore Case. Ex-cop's DNA, quote, found on the ligature that tied Birchmore's neck to a closet door handle, end quote. And this is Rick Sobey writing. A former Stoughton police officer accused of killing a pregnant woman allegedly left his DNA on the murder weapon, according to the feds. Matthew Farwell is charged with the murder of 23-year-old Sandra Birchmore and her unborn child to prevent her from disclosing information about Farwell's other alleged federal crimes. Farwell allegedly raped Birchmore as a child, continued to have sex with her when she became an adult, believed she was pregnant with his child, and killed her in February of 2021, staging the crime scene to make it look like Birchmore committed suicide, according to prosecutors. As Farwell pushes for his release ahead of the trial, the feds are revealing new evidence to support Farwell's detention. The feds wrote in a Monday filing, quote, there is clear and convincing evidence that Farwell is a danger to the community and a preponderance of the evidence that he is a risk of obstruction and flight. Farwell should remain in custody pending trial. The evidence proving that Farwell committed the offenses alleged in the superseding indictment has gotten stronger since the defendant's arrest, end quote. Farwell faces a potential life sentence if he's convicted. The U.S. Attorney's Office is now divulging new DNA evidence that allegedly ties Farwell to the murder of Birchmore and her unborn child. His DNA was on the strap that was used to asphyxiate Birchmore, according to the feds. Back in 2021, the Massachusetts State Police Crime Laboratory conducted tests and found male DNA on the ligature that was around Birchmore's neck. The feds wrote in the new filing, quote, however, despite detecting DNA on these items, no meaningful conclusions could be drawn from this evidence in 2021. That is because state investigators did not obtain DNA from Farwell or anyone else, end quote. But in 2024, the FBI obtained a federal search warrant authorizing agents to obtain a DNA sample from Farwell. His DNA was compared to the DNA found on the ligature from which Birchmore hung, as well as the DNA under Birchmore's fingernails and the sperm in her underwear. The feds wrote, quote, "While Farwell correctly states in his memorandum that his DNA was not found under Birchmore's fingernails, he fails to mention that Farwell's DNA was found on the ligature that tied Birchmore's neck to a closet door handle. The presence of Farwell's DNA on the murder weapon, that is, the strap used to asphyxiate Birchmore, is, of course, highly inculpatory." End quote. Farwell's sperm cells were detected in multiple locations on the underwear that Birchmore was wearing when she was found dead, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. The feds added, quote, "The presence of Farwell's sperm in Birchmore's underwear renders it highly likely that he lied to Massachusetts State Police detectives during his brief interaction with them in the school parking lot on February 6, 2021, when he claimed that the last time he had sex with Birchmore was in October 2020. This lie is relevant to Farwell's state of mind and his consciousness of guilt." End quote. Although a DNA test proved Farwell was not the father, he allegedly groomed Birchmore from a young age, starting a sexual relationship with her when she was a minor that continued until her death. Birchmore's death in 2021 was initially ruled a suicide, and state prosecutors from the Norfolk DA's office declined to bring charges against Farwell. The federal trial is expected to begin in October. And that was Rick Sobey writing on that. At just about 32 minutes past the hour, I am going to turn to the Herald editorial and opinion pages. The editorial today is entitled, "What Does Belt Tightening Look Like at City Hall?" The city of Boston has the same problem too many of its residents do. There's more money going out than there is coming in. Bostonians recognize this as belt-tightening time, an unwelcome concept for Mayor Michelle Wu, who cited previous year's budget growth of 4% and 8% as she unveiled the FY27 budget with an increase of 2.1%. It's, quote, "well below the current rate of inflation," end quote. The problem isn't exclusive to Boston, nor is it a surprise. Last summer, the Pew Charitable Trusts reported that since the beginning of 2025, at least 20 of the nation's 25 most populous cities had reported budget gaps for fiscal year 2026 and often beyond, based on a news reports, budget documents, and communications with city officials. Ashley Groffenberger, Boston's chief financial officer, told Pew, quote, "We feel fortunate the city is in really good shape. If we focus on constraining expenditure growth, we will weather whatever is happening out there," end quote. What's happening out there? Rising costs, revenue sources struggling to keep up, reduced federal support, and increased fiscal and economic uncertainty. Wu tagged those in her budget proposal to the City Council Monday. The fallout should be enlightening, as Wu officials said many long-term vacant positions won't be filled. If a vacant position isn't filled, and it doesn't affect how the city functions, Was that position even necessary? While the idea of a city council audit is anathema to the powers that be, as evidenced by the blocking of orders calling for an audit of city finances and review of spending put forth by two Boston city councilors last week, the actions by the Wu administration going forward will shed some light on how money is being spent. How many long vacant positions are there? And has there been any negative effects from them being unfilled? Could the city do without them? Wu also cited the end of federal American Rescue Plan Act funding that is leading the city to cut back on or cease funding for many discretionary grant programs that support small businesses and nonprofits, fill vacant storefronts, and expand cultural programming. Don't we need more businesses in Boston? Aren't we trying to revitalize areas of the city by attracting more retailers in vacant storefronts? If these things are getting trimmed, what's being saved? And why not let the Boston City Council in on the plans? Wu officials said they do not anticipate an, quote, increased use, end quote, of the city's roughly $1 billion reserve fund to balance the budget to avoid creating a structural problem in the budget. Reserves are for tough times, and by the looks of it, Boston has to weather a fiscal storm on several fronts. If ever there was a time to dip into the reserve fund, this would be it. Before you know it, we'll be at the door of FY28. There could be a massive turnaround, businesses flocking to the city, government aid turning the spigot back on, costs remaining static. Barring that miracle, what's the plan? And that was the editorial today in the Boston Herald. Brook Creek, B-R-O-O-K-E-C-R-E-E-K, is a veteran, a military spouse, and a team member at Hire Heroes USA, and she's writing under the subsection Employment, Support Military Families with the WOTC. And WOTC stands for Work Opportunity Tax Credit. And this is her thinking. For military families, the stakes could not be higher. The WOTC is a federal tax incentive for employers who hire individuals from specific groups facing barriers to employment, with veterans as a primary target group. Despite its promise, the program has not kept pace with the realities of military family employment. Fewer than 10% of WOTC credits issued in 2023 supported veteran hires, and veterans consistently make up only a small share of recipients. When targeted effectively, however, WOTC demonstrates strong potential. The data show that when employers know a job candidate qualifies for the WOTC, they are 8% to 10% more likely to hire veterans. The expiration of the WOTC at the end of 2025 presents a critical opportunity to reauthorize and modernize the program to better support employment outcomes for veterans and military families. And that date of expiration of 2025 does not seem right, but that is what is written here. I'll read that again. That's what's written in her letter. The expiration of the WOTC at the end of 2025 presents a critical opportunity to reauthorize and modernize the program to better support employment outcomes for veterans and military families. It might mean the end expiration at the end of 2026, but I'm not sure. I apologize for not knowing that. Military spouses who face unemployment rates above 20% are not included among targeted groups. That omission ignores economic logic and common sense. In 2003, I joined the military. Years later, I reconnected with the man who would become my husband, and together we decided he would join the Navy. That choice changed the trajectory of our family's life. When my husband enlisted in the Navy in 2010, the stability of military life made it possible for me to return to school. Housing, food, and a built-in community gave me the breathing room I needed to finish my degree and even go on to graduate school. Over the last 16 years as a military spouse, we've moved from Florida to Texas, Louisiana, and now Washington, D.C. With every move came a recurring challenge. How to keep a career moving forward while constantly having to start over. That uncertainty is something military spouses live with every day. I was incredibly fortunate to land a job with Hire Heroes USA, a nonprofit that helps veterans, transitioning service members, and military spouses secure meaningful employment. For more than a decade, I lived a very different reality, one that far too many military spouses still face today. Military spouses are highly educated, resilient, and mobile by necessity. They bring adaptability, leadership, and problem-solving skills that employers across industries need. Yet, frequent relocations and licensing barriers leave many underemployed or pushed out of the workforce entirely. Expanding WOTC eligibility to military spouses would provide employers with a clear incentive to recruit, hire, and retain this talent while strengthening household stability for families who already sacrifice so much. Together, policy incentives like WOTC and targeted workforce programs such as serving spouses at Hire Heroes USA, and that's the program is called Serving Spouses at Hire Heroes USA, create a powerful pathway for military spouses to secure meaningful, sustainable careers. Congress should reauthorize and modernize the Work Opportunity Tax Credit by strengthening accountability, rewarding veteran retention, incentivizing proactive recruitment, and expanding eligibility to military spouses. That last paragraph, that Congress should reauthorize the WOTC, expired at the end of 2025, explains that, I guess. And that was Brook Creek writing as a veteran military spouse and team member at Hire Heroes USA. Rick Sobey is writing under the subsection Transit. And the article is entitled, Rail Tickets Spike to $80 for the World Cup. MBTA hikes prices for special rides to Gillette Stadium on game days. And this is Rick Sobey. It's not only World Cup game ticket prices that are skyrocketing. The MBTA has announced that it's spiking commuter rail ticket prices for football fans to travel from Boston to Foxborough. Round-trip T-tickets between South Station and Gillette Stadium for the World Cup in June and July will be $80, which is four times the $20 fare for Patriots games, concerts, and Boston Legacy FC games this season. Compared to the upcoming traffic nightmare and expensive parking, the T argues that taking the commuter rail's expanded service for $80, quote, provides a predictable and more affordable way to travel to and from matches, end quote. Parking will be very limited at Gillette Stadium, with spots starting at $175. That's $175 for parking at Gillette. The MBTA tickets will cost $320 for a family of four. MBTA GM and CEO Philip Eng said in a statement, quote, "With our service plans and pricing announced today, we encourage the public to kick the drive and use the MBTA's Boston Stadium train service instead. Taking the commuter rail will be one of the easiest and most affordable ways to get to and from the stadium," end quote. The T plans to run a, quote, "unprecedented amount of service for the World Cup," end quote, transporting up to 20,000 riders to and from each of the seven matches. This is about 10 times the typical 2,000 riders for a Patriots game. To meet this demand, the T took on a $35 million project to upgrade Foxborough Station in advance of the World Cup. There are also costs associated with deploying many additional customer service and operations staff, enhancing security operations, operating later bus and subway service on match days, and other upgrades. The $80 train tickets are also good for unlimited travel across the entire commuter rail network on match days. Complete Gillette Stadium train schedules to the seven World Cup matches are available on the schedule page at mbta.com/Boston Stadium Trains. And that was Rick Sobey writing on that plan for the matches. Marsha Dunn of the Associated Press is writing under the subsection NASA. And her article is entitled "Artemis II Sails Through a Trip Around the Moon. The Spacecraft Surpasses Apollo 13's Distance Record." This is Marsha Dunn of the Associated Press writing this. Dateline Houston. With the moon now filling their windows, the Artemis II astronauts sailed into their lunar flyby Monday, taking in magnificent views of the far side never before witnessed, while setting a new distance record for humanity. The six-hour flyby is the highlight of NASA's first return to the moon since the Apollo era, with three Americans and one Canadian, a step toward landing boot prints near the moon's south pole in just 2 years. First came a prize and bragging rights for Artemis II. Less than an hour before kicking off the fly-around and intense lunar observations, the four astronauts surpassed the distance record of 248,655 miles set by Apollo 13 in April 1970. They kept going, hurtling ever farther from Earth. Before it was over, Artemis II beat the old record by 4,101 miles. Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen radioed ahead of the flyby, quote, It is blowing my mind what you can see with the naked eye from the moon right now. It is just unbelievable, end quote. He challenged, quote, this generation and the next to make sure this record is not long-lived, end quote. Moments after breaking Apollo 13's record, the astronauts asked permission to name two fresh lunar craters already observed. They proposed Integrity, their capsule's name, and Carol, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. Carol, in honor of Commander Reed Wiseman's wife, who died of cancer in 2020. Wiseman wept as Hansen put in the request to Mission Control, and all four astronauts embraced in tears. Wiseman radioed once he regained his composure and started picture taking, quote, such a majestic view out here, end quote. The astronauts called down that they managed to capture the moon and Earth in the same shot and provided a running commentary to scientists back in Houston on what they were seeing. Some peaks were so bright, pilot Victor Glover noted, that they looked as though they were covered in snow. Besides photographing the scenes with high-powered Nikon cameras, the astronauts also pulled out their iPhones for some impromptu shots. Wiseman, Glover, Hansen, and Christina Koch started the momentous day with the voice of Apollo 13 commander Jim Lovell, who recorded a wake-up message just 2 months before his death last August. Lovell said, who also flew on Apollo 8, humanity's first lunar visit, quote, and this was pre-recorded, quote, welcome to my old neighborhood. It's a historic day, and I know how busy you'll be, but don't forget to enjoy the view, end quote. From Jim Lovell. They took up with them the Apollo 8 silk patch that accompanied Lovell to the moon and showed it off as the crucial flyby approached. Wiseman said, quote, it's just a real honor to have that on board with us. Let's go. Have a great day, end, go, end quote. Artemis II is using the same maneuver that Apollo 13 did after its, quote, Houston, we've had a problem, end quote, oxygen tank explosion wiped out any hope of a moon landing. Known as a free return lunar trajectory, this no-stopping-to-land route takes advantage of Earth and the moon's gravity, reducing the need for fuel. It's a celestial figure eight that put the astronauts on course for home once they emerged from behind the moon Monday evening. The Artemis II crew ducked behind the moon more than halfway through the lunar flyby. During the 40-minute communications blackout, they made their closest approach to the moon, 4,067 miles, and reached their maximum distance of 252,756 miles from Earth. At that point, they were homeward bound, taking 4 days to get back, with a Pacific splashdown concluding their test flight on Friday. Their estimated speed at closest approach to the moon was 3,139 miles per hour. Wiseman and his crew spent years studying lunar geography to prepare for the big event, adding solar eclipses to their repertoire during the past few weeks. By launching last Wednesday, they ensured themselves of a total solar eclipse from their vantage point behind the moon, courtesy of the cosmos. Topping their science target list, Oriental Basin, and that's spelled O-R-I-E-N-T-A-L-E, Oriental Basement, Basin, pardon me, Oriental Basin. A sprawling impact basin with three concentric rings, the outermost of which stretches nearly 600 miles across. Other sightseeing goals, the Apollo 12 and 14 landing sites from 1969 and 1971, respectively, as well as fringes of the South Polar region, the preferred locale for future touchdowns. Farther afield, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Saturn, not to mention Earth, will be visible. Their moon mentor, NASA geologist Kelsey Young, expects thousands of pictures. And this goes on, this article, interestingly, goes on a few more paragraphs, but we have run out of time reading the Herald. This is Mary Ellen. Thank you for listening.